It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for April 23rd, 2022. And it's a milestone. Today is our 600th episode. Yes, 600. And looking back to that very first episode in September of 2010, it just doesn't seem possible that it's been over 11 years. I was asked recently about my affiliation with WJCU, the radio station that has been home to The Outspoken Cyclist since 2010, right from the beginning. In fact, WJCU is still the home for the show. Even though there is no longer a broadcast, you can always find the recent episode at WJCU.org, as well as through your subscription via a podcast app or at OutspokenCyclist.com. And if you're looking for great local programming, music, sports, and more, you can always tune in to 88.7 FM in Northeast Ohio or WJCU.org online. My thanks to the staff of WJCU. I'm eternally grateful for the station's continued support. This week, we're going to talk about Vision Zero and why it's achieving its goals across the globe, except for the United States. When on-the-road fatalities are down 30 to 50% in other countries, they are up by double digits in some states here. And David Zipper thinks we need to get mad, really mad, to bring attention to the carnage that is happening on our roads. David is a visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Taubman Center for State and Local Government. He is a contributing writer at Bloomberg City Lab and has written extensively for Slate, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Wired, just to name a few. His abiding interests in cities, mobility, transportation, and safety, along with his broad and deep background in government, finance, and more, have all combined to give him a unique and authoritative perspective on what we need to do to get our heads on straight about how we live and how we move. Hello, David. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad we get to talk today. John Sirico is a friend of mine, and I talk to him a lot. And I read your piece in Bloomberg recently about Vision Zero. And we've had Leah Shaham on the show in the past, and we've talked about Vision Zero. And it doesn't seem to be getting anywhere here in the States, according to your article. But I want to start with your background.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It's funny. I feel like a lot of people I know who get deep into transportation with cities come from a different point of view, or they sort of gravitated into transportation from something else, whether it's, you know, it could be working in finance, it could be working in journalism, it could be working, frankly, with like museums. I'm thinking of a few people that I know. And for me, my sort of path into transportation sort of begins with economic development. Back when I was a college student at a small school outside of Philadelphia called Swarthmore College, I was always interested in cities. I just found cities to be dynamic, exciting places. I grew up in a college town called Chapel Hill, and it was always exciting when my family could visit family in New York or go on a vacation to San Francisco or something like that. So I was always just inherently attracted to cities. And, you know, social justice matters to me. It always has, matters a lot to my family. And so when I was at Swarthmore in the 1990s, that was a time when some of the older people listening to your podcast might remember an old program called the Empowerment Zones under President Clinton, which was meant to revitalize struggling inner city neighborhoods. That's the term we used at the time. And my friend and I basically launched a nonprofit in college in inner city North Philadelphia. and a neighborhood called Kensington, where I'd done some volunteer work, a Puerto Rican African-American neighborhood. We wanted to find a way to bring money from the suburbs into the city. So we set up a painting business to basically train people in this neighborhood of Philadelphia to go be painters and get them jobs in the main line of Philadelphia suburbs where they could make some money and gain some skills. So that was sort of my first foray into cities. And I sort of got hooked. I just love thinking about how they change, how to improve people's lives. And I'll fast forward a bit. I basically got pretty into economic development professionally, working with a Harvard Business School professor named Michael Porter, working in the New York City government under Mayor Bloomberg to run an economic development program. And then in Washington, D.C., where I live, I've lived for over 12 years now, I ran economic development strategy for two mayors from 2009 to 2013. And for those who follow urban transportation, if you know D.C., that was like this crazy time when Gabe Klein was running the Department of Transportation in D.C. We had bike share launch. We had bike lanes going up on Pennsylvania Avenue. Ride Hail was fighting it out with the taxis. And I found myself thinking, you know, this is actually a really exciting place where you can actually change a lot of people's lives. And we're frankly rethinking a lot of things we got wrong. So that sort of hooked me. And I began to think, you know, transportation might actually be the place that where I actually feel like I could do a lot of good. And long story short, I ended up working in venture capital and working with startups in the transportation smart city space for several years after leaving the city. But then after that, and this has been the last several years, I've tried to sort of leverage what I know about the policymaking process, as well as sort of like the private sector and startup world, to help sort of guide all this change that's coming to our streets and our cities to be productive rather than be problematic. And that has to do with everything from scooters to autonomous vehicles to ride hail to rethinking the role of transit. And so today I am a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. I'm a contributing writer at Bloomberg City Lab, and I write a lot in Slate and The Atlantic and Washington Post. If folks are curious, they can get an overview at my website, which is davidzipper.com.
Well, you just took care of the reintroduction. That works.
You know, it's efficient.
I had it all written out, visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School at Taubman Center for State and Local Government and a contributing writer. And I did find you on Bloomberg, and I'm really glad I did, because this is a super interesting conversation. So I just want to back up a little bit. You went to Swarthmore, which my mother would have like died and went to heaven if I had gone there. She had told me she wanted me to. I'm from Philadelphia, and I really am well aware of this whole sort of area that you're speaking about when you were in college. So you talk about something called mobility tech. What's mobility tech, and how do you define that?
Well, I think, you know, we take it for granted, especially people who are younger than you or me these days, that transportation is sort of like, we have these new ways of getting around cities that seem to pop up frequently. But if you take a step back, it's kind of incredible that in, you know, 1920 and in 2000, you pretty much had the same modes of transportation. You could walk, you could bike, you could take a car, a taxi, you could take transit. Those are pretty much the options in 1920 and in 2000. There were certainly changes in the form factors, but there wasn't anything that was really like a wholesale or disruptive change. And then in the last 20 years, for a combination of reasons, including the emergence of smartphones, cloud computing, the improvement in batteries, we've seen this like Cambrian explosion of mobility technologies. And in this case, I'm talking about form factors, everything from car share and ride hail to autonomous vehicles, to drones, to e-scooters and bike share, electric bikes, which I would argue are a whole other mode of transport. And it's still going on. And it frankly caught everybody flat-footed. I know this because I was in city government. We were scrambling to figure out what to do about Uber. No one had any idea. And you still see these fights happening now over modes like whether it's scooters that we're mad at today or something else tomorrow. To me, that's part of what makes this whole field so exciting at the moment, is that there's so many new technologies that are being introduced, form factors in particular, but also some other elements like wayfinding tools, Google Maps for that reason. What has Google Maps allowed you to do that you couldn't have done 30 years ago? So to me, it's an exciting time to think about how technology applies to mobility.
It is an exciting time, but I also see it's fraught with some issues that you know, and your Vision Zero article brings that up. We're going to get to that in the second half of our conversation. So what are some of the most pressing issues that you are encountering in transportation sustainability and equity, and how do you help cities and governments assess those problems and find solutions? And that's a big topic.
We are addicted to cars and we don't realize it.
Oh, I do, but I know what you mean. Yes. We are totally addicted to cars.
I mean, that to me is sort of like the true north of everything that I try to do, is to sort of wean our cities away from these cataclysmic errors we made in the 20th century. It's just tragic. If you go back and read the history, which I hope some folks who listen have done, like, you know, shrinking sidewalks to let cars go faster in St. Louis and Detroit, destroying minority neighborhoods to make ways for expressways. I mean, we've suffered in health, we've suffered with inequality, we've suffered with pollution, obviously, in so many ways, and it's going to be really hard to get back. And it's kind of funny to me that so many of our friends will go to Italy or France on vacation and love the experience of walking around a city that's oriented for pedestrians and people on transit and cyclists. And they'll think, oh, it was fantastic. And then they come back to Dallas, or they come back to Phoenix or suburban Cleveland even. And there's just no connection made between what that experience was and how much they loved it and where they actually live today. So a lot of what I do is try to think about ways in which we can improve our transit service, ways that we can leverage technologies like e-bikes or bike share or ride hail for that matter, to get a little bit closer towards, to at least give people in cities the option of not being reliant on a car. You can't flip a switch and redo all the mistakes we made for 100 years. But what you can do is build out neighborhoods that are walkable, that are fun, where technology helps make them walkable and fun, and provide an opportunity for those who want to be there to live there or to go there, and hope that the good news spreads, if you will.
Do you have an example? Because I look at where we are in Cleveland and it feels so disjointed, you know, these little ring suburbs that don't connect to one another or don't connect to downtown. And even though there's this effort to make those pathways and make it safer, because that's one of the biggest issues, is people don't feel safe on the streets. I wonder why, you know, that was sarcastic. Do you have a place in mind that actually sort of embodies that idea of walkable, livable, that has changed from being a car-centric city?
A place that has changed from being a car-centric city to being less so.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're really just starting to wrap our minds around this. I think there are some places that never went totally car-centric that when we think about, that's why we love being there, like Boston's North End, which was cut off by the central artery for so long. And lo and behold, you have this amazing walkable Italian neighborhood there. Where I live in Washington, D.C., it's often praised for being more walkable and sort of manageable and pleasant than many other big older cities in the United States. Well, you know what? We didn't have an interstate slicing through our city. We dodged that bullet. If you think, we have New York Avenue, but that's not an interstate. It sucks. I don't like it, but it's not an interstate. It's nothing like what Detroit had to endure. So in terms of examples that I point to, I guess I'd bring up two things. One is that, just to show how brainwashed we are, I always think it's fascinating looking at 14th Street in Manhattan and how when it went car-free in October 2019, it was very controversial when this happened, turned to a busway. And when you talk to people about what their reaction was, or you go read the articles at the time, like, yes, everybody expected the buses would go faster and crashes would decline. But what nobody expected is that people just loved being there on a street without cars. They called it the miracle on 14th Street. And even the advocates who were pushing for it did not expect this overwhelming response of, oh my God, I can actually like hear people. I don't feel unsafe. It's so nice just hanging out there. So yeah, that's Manhattan. And there's only one Manhattan in the United States. But to me, I'd love to see that kind of experience be available to people in a lot of other places. I don't know Cleveland the way that you know Cleveland by any stretch, but they're even in Cleveland too. There's pockets that have gotten hot, as I understand, in the last 10 years, like Ohio City, right?
Right.
Why? It's walkable.
Tremont. Right.
Tremont, right. Tremont, Ohio, like you can actually like hang out there and go
you
to
can.
Restaurants. Like to me, when real estate values start to increase and developers realize, wait, there's something going on here, politicians start to appreciate it, people just start to gravitate more toward those areas where they want to live. You end up with something of a positive feedback loop that I'm hoping will continue for in the years to come.
I think that's a great place to take a break. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to speak with David some more about his article about Vision Zero and what he saw happening and what he sees happening in Europe as opposed to the US. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you are just joining me, I am speaking with David Zipper. He is the visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School Taubman Center for State and Local Government. He's a contributing writer to Bloomberg City Lab. That's how I found him, one of the articles that he did there, and a whole lot more. So when we took our break, we decided we were going to talk about this article, which is how I found you, about Vision Zero. And we will post a link to that article on the Outspoken Cyclist blog and tell you how to get to it, because it's really, really interesting. Why isn't Vision Zero working in the US? I mean, it is working elsewhere.
Do you think everybody knows what Vision Zero is? Is that where
we can define it. Why not?
I always think it's useful just because, frankly, in the US, we've sort of bastardized its original meaning.
Well, that's a good point. Let's define it in its originality.
Yeah, I mean, originally the concept comes from Scandinavia and Sweden in particular. And the idea is that human beings are fallible in all ways of life, including how we travel. So rather than try to design a traffic system where nobody makes a mistake, let's just assume mistakes will be made and design a sort of forgiving transportation network such that when mistakes happen, you know, maybe an accident or excuse me, not an accident, a crash will still occur, but it will not be fatal. It might be a fender bender or an injury. So that leads to things like the adoption of road diets, lower speed limits. It can lead to safer car regulations, automatic camera enforcement, things like this. It's been very effective in Europe. Like Sweden and Norway have seen over a 50% decline in crashes over a 20-year period, or over fatalities, excuse me, I should say. And in Europe overall, crashes and fatalities are declining. And the Vision Zero concept got really popular in the US over the last decade, with cities starting with Chicago in 2012, then including dozens of cities signing on, every place from San Francisco and New York to Fort Lauderdale, Boston, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, in the US, our traffic fatality rates are going up in cities, not down once we sign on to Vision Zero. And so I wrote a pretty lengthy piece in City Lab trying to understand why. And when you get down to it, it's sort of, if you had to put your, it's a complicated set of reasons why, but if you want to boil it down to something, it's kind of what we were talking about earlier, Diane. It's like, it's that we've designed our cities around car speed. You know, Salida Reynolds, the director of Los Angeles DOT, said to me, like, there's just an inverse relationship between car speed and safety. You can't enhance one without sacrificing the other. And we've tried to have it both ways. And if we can't have it both ways, we opt for car speed in how we design our cities and our streets. And what you end up with Vision Zero is politicians sort of saying, yes, I support safety. Absolutely. This is great. But then when the actual policy changes are proposed, things like shrinking the width of a street or lowering a speed limit, that's when the drivers get angry and the politicians get nervous and things get slowed down. And it's a huge problem. And there's other issues I could bring in about what happens at the state and federal level that gets in the way of Vision Zero as well. But I hate to say it, in the United States, Vision Zero has become a slogan, not an actual set of programs that it really does save lives.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, just looking at some of the statistics that you cited in your article, that when Vision Zero was adopted in 2015 in LA, 200 people have been killed in the city. Last year, or in 2021, 289 people were killed on LA streets. I mean, it's just beyond me. Tell me about how the pandemic changed things on even a short-term basis and why that hasn't stuck.
So the pandemic made everything worse. We were already an anomaly in among developed countries with an increasing rate of traffic deaths, particularly among pedestrians and cyclists. Europe, Japan, South Korea, Canada even are all seeing declines, but not us. This is pre-pandemic. Then with the pandemic, it was sort of like an accelerant for those pre-existing trends. Europe saw a much sharper decline in fatalities, while we did not. Some of your listeners might know this, but in 2020, we had the fastest rate of growth in fatalities per mile driven since President Coolidge was in the White House, 1924. It's really bad. And it's interesting, the sort of default explanation of groups like AAA and some of the sort of like auto establishment traffic safety groups is to say, oh, well, drivers went crazy. They just are so bad. They're just kind of nutty because they've been stuck at home for so long.
You can say what you wanted to say.
Yeah, well, maybe I will next time. So I have a few minutes to go here.
Yeah.
And then that's the default. It's like, okay, so it's driver's fault for going nuts. And I push back against that. And I say, well, if people just went nuts during COVID, why is the US the only place that saw this spike in traffic deaths? Did Belgians not go crazy due to COVID? Does COVID just not affect Canadians the way it affects Americans behind the wheel? Or is it possible, perhaps, that we designed our transportation network to invite speeding so that we have wide lanes, we have speed limits set too high, we invite people to drive recklessly fast, and the only thing that has slowed them down in the past is congestion. So when you remove congestion, which happened during COVID with the lockdowns, you sort of pave the way for people to drive really recklessly. Maybe that's a differentiator. And this gets to what I think is an underlying problem in American traffic safety. And I wrote about this in The Atlantic last fall. We have a default setting in the United States to blame individuals for crashes. It's your fault. You made a mistake. You should have done better than to crash. And, you know, I'm not going to exonerate all the people behind the wheel. Some people, especially if you have a pattern of reckless behavior, you shouldn't be driving. However, we're never going to truly address traffic safety if we don't adopt the Vision Zero mentality of treating this as the societal problem that it is, and looking at how we've designed roads and designed cars and designed enforcement, because those are societal systemic elements that Europe and East Asia have been way better at recognizing and addressing than we have. We just didn't choose to blame the driver for everything, or blame the pedestrian or the cyclist. That does not help. In fact, it's counterproductive because it allows us to tell ourselves that, oh, it's those people's fault for making a mistake. We don't have to actually change our rules or how we go about designing roads and cars, because they're just a few bad apples. It's a fundamental misfire in the United States on traffic safety, in my view.
What do you think is going to change, if anything, with the infrastructure bill? I mean, we're still looking at repairing roads, repairing bridges, but we are talking about not building new ones necessarily, not widening streets. Are we going to see any of that money coming into the Vision Zero like mentality?
Yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated with the infrastructure bill because there are some good things within it. There's $6 billion for a new Safe Roads for All program that is specifically designed for support for the sorts of infrastructure improvements that you and I would want to see. But there's also a ton of money going straight to the state DOTs that are notorious for just seeing any problem that exists. The answer is widen the highway. Texas DOT is especially notorious for this. So what we really need is to stop widening highways and building new ones and invest in transit and in bike lanes and in the infrastructure that allows us to do better with what we have and to improve, frankly, what we have as alternatives for driving. My fear is that we, with the infrastructure bill, just threw basically money at everything, which is not how you actually drive societal progress.
So if we were to take whatever money's coming to Ohio, let's say, and we have a, we actually have a bicycle coordinator at the state level in the DOT, somebody there who is talking to whoever he or she, I think it's a she, is talking to our state DOT. How do you convince these people that they're going down the wrong path? What is it going to take? I know this is a big question. What is it going to take to get people, forgetting the drivers for a minute, because you have to take away their streets before they figure it out. But it has to start somewhere. What's it going to take and where should it start to make these changes so that people aren't dying on the roads?
It's going to require a number of different things. And there's no silver bullet. There's no panacea. One piece of it is we need to change how we train transportation engineers so that they recognize that their job is not just to allow cars to go fast and pedestrians aren't simply obstacles for them achieving a beautiful road. They need to see success looking differently. If you look at some of the highways and road redesigns that get awards from ASHTO, which is the National Association of State Highway Transportation Engineers, it's very clear that they have no idea what we're talking about when we say that we need more roads that accommodate people who are traveling who are not driving. Like, they're giving awards to things that look beautiful from the sky and look like hell if you're a walker or pedestrian trying to cross it. But that's not enough. Education is a piece of it. We also need, and I'm emphatic about this, we frankly need people to get angry around traffic safety. This is how we have had progress in the past around drunk driving. It's how we had progress for a while in the 1910s and early 20s in the early days of auto safety is because people in cities were furious at these automobile drivers who were endangering children who had played in the streets for centuries, literally. And now suddenly they were dying because of these cars running through. It's a long story told very well in a book called Fighting Traffic about how that played out. A guy named Peter Norton, a historian at University of Virginia, wrote it. But I genuinely believe that it's a good thing that ghost bikes have become a common thing that you see where a cyclist is killed. I would love to see more protests. I'd love to see outrage directed at the state of Ohio, at the city of Cleveland, at NHTSA, the Federal Agency for Highway Traffic, that we are seeing a 50% increase over the last decade in cyclist and pedestrian fatalities, and NHTSA still has not introduced crash protection, crash ratings for cars to look at how risky an automobile is for pedestrians. Europe and Japan and South Korea have had this for decades, and NHTSA still won't do it. I would love to see a protest at USDOT demanding answers for why NHTSA is dragging its feet on safety protections around car design that the rest of the world has adopted a long time ago. So I see a number of different things that need to happen for us to be able to turn the corner here. And I don't think it's helpful to simply nag the drivers and say, please stop looking at your phone, or please drive more respectfully. It doesn't work. We need to think systemically and be smarter and frankly, get angrier.
Well, it sounds like a movement. We need a movement.
We do.
I think it's really an important way of looking at it. I'm not sure, you know, now, of course, my brain is just going in 80 million directions at once, trying to figure out how to get that started. DC seems to be the right place to start it, because that's where the bike summit is. That's where people like Blumenauer are. You know, there are some advocates. But the anger, you know, when it's your child or your loved one, then you get angry. But until it is, you know, you get in your car and you don't even think about it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, everybody thinks that they're an above average driver. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's really sad, but it's inevitable that people die that way, that die in a car crash. I'm not going to pretend that I have the answer for how to get there. And I think there, frankly, are also some people who are doing good work, groups like Transportation Alternatives in New York and WABA in DC, where I live, groups like that. But they're very small compared to the auto industry lobbying prowess. And we need a lot. We need a groundswell of popular support. So I don't know. I think about this quite a bit. And I feel like part of my role in this sort of space, as it were, is being with a foot in academia and a foot writing and doing some advisory work, which I do with certain cities and transit agencies and the like, is to just sort of underscore how outrageous the status quo is. And try to put a spot, like, we should be really angry that our political leaders have co-opted this program, Vision Zero, that has saved lives in Europe and turned it into effectively an empty slogan in the United States. We should be angry. And I would love to be part of those conversations and that movement to help drive change. But along the way, maybe I'm hoping what I can do is to basically increase the temperature and the smoke so that people like you and the listeners can be like, this is really bad. Maybe I should be voting on this basis. Maybe I should be donating some money to advocacy groups. Maybe this is something I should be asking questions of my congressman or state representative about, because that's where this stuff starts. I really believe that we're going to need, it's going to take a long time, but it's absolutely essential.
What a great note to end on. I absolutely agree. We've been speaking with David Zipper, and he's a contributing writer to Bloomberg. He's a visiting fellow and I can never remember the whole thing. I have to turn the page.
Hey, I know. It's not enough words. You need more words in the title. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Harvard Kennedy School's Taubman Center for State and Local Government. Meanwhile, he's got some really, really cool things to say. We will put his website up. And I really appreciate the way you're thinking about this. And maybe we can make some people angry. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And I'll just say, if people want to get in touch or are curious about the articles that I'm writing and the like, there's the website. And also, you can always reach me on Twitter @DavidZipper. Thanks for having me, though. I appreciate it, Diane.
You have a great day. And thanks. My thanks to David Zipper for a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find out more about David, read his writing, and contact him at davidzipper.com. You can reach out to him on Twitter @DavidZipper. For all of those who have been experiencing the iron grip of winter, including much of our family, we hope warmer temps are on their way to you this weekend. We keep our thoughts and good intentions on the people of Ukraine. I'll be back soon with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. In the meantime, please stay safe. Stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.